She nodded. He was bound, just barely. It doesn't happen to all of us. But Daniel was still too new for the changeover to be certain. It was a miracle he survived. Stefan was so angry. She took a sip of coffee and grimaced. I hate cold coffee. She took another sip anyway. Andre did it on purpose, you know. One of those stupid one-upmanship games. He was terribly jealous of Stefan because Marsilia favored him, and at the same time he loved Stefan like a brother. So when he was angry, he attacked one of us instead. Vampires don't usually care too much about the sheep in their menageries. I don't think Andre realized just how angry Stefan would get. What happened to Joey? I asked. She's dead, Naomi told her coffee cup.
Permanently dead, Rachel said. I thought it was her on the motorcycle. She was wearing a helmet, and she doesn't let anyone, not even Stefan, touch the hog. When I finally realized the rider wasn't tall enough to be her, I tried to run back to the house.
She grabbed your arm, I suggested. It wasn't a difficult guess with the armband of bruises she wore. Rachel nodded.
And covered my mouth so I couldn't scream. About then, a car drove up, one of the Seethe cars.
Like the one Andre had driven last night. I worked on them from time to time in lieu of making a cash payment to the Seethe. All the businesses in the greater Tri-Cities who weren't affiliated with more powerful groups paid protection money to the vampires. That's how I first met Stefan. He had helped me negotiate my payment from cash, which I couldn't afford, to work, mostly on his van, as it turned out, though I did the upkeep on the Seethe's cars as well. They were Mercedes and BMWs, big black sedans with dark, dark windows, just what you'd expect a bunch of vampires to drive.
They popped open the trunk, and I thought they were going to shove me in, but it was worse than that. They already had Joey in there.
She jumped up abruptly and ran from the room. I heard her throwing up. They killed Joey, cut off her head so she would never become one of them. Naomi spoke evenly, but had to set down her coffee so she wouldn't spill it. They told Rachel that we were to stay inside this house until they decided what to do with us. They didn't have to kill Joey to deliver that message. They could just have brought her back here. Or one of them could have brought her over, the way Andre brought over Daniel.
Rachel said, she. Was it Marsilia? I asked.
Naomi shook her head.
It was the teacher.
Marsilia, Stefan was a favorite of hers. I don't think she'd have killed one of us.
The teacher, I asked.
Her real name is Estelle. She reminds me of an evil Mary Poppins. I knew the one she meant. They all have names among themselves, she explained. Stefan was a soldier. Andre is the courtier. Stefan said it had to do with an old suspicion that if you spoke evil's name, you drew its attention. Stefan didn't believe in it, but some of the older vampires won't use real names when they talk of others.
So, Estelle, I said her name deliberately, went against Marsilia's wishes?
No. Well, probably, but not against her orders.
I'm trying to understand how the Seethe works, I told her. That's why I came here.
Rachel came back in the room looking even more pale than she had before.
I thought you were looking for Stefan.
I nodded. They wouldn't care about Samuel and Adam.
I think that there is more going on than just a vampire-turned-sorcerer. I wonder, for instance, who turned the sorcerer into a vampire?
You think there's another vampire involved? Naomi asked.
Stefan said that the sorcerer was a new-made vampire. It occurred to me that his maker might be pulling the monster's strings, but I don't really know enough about vampires to make an educated guess.
I do, Naomi said slowly, straightening in her chair.
Something shifted in her face, and I saw yesterday's competent woman take control.
I can help you, but there's a price.
What price? I asked.
I somehow doubted that she wanted me to sing for her. She didn't have Uncle Mike's sense of humor. And as the thought occurred to me, I finally figured out that once Uncle Mike claimed me as his guest, the Fae couldn't do anything bad to me without challenging him, which was why the big woman had sighed in disappointment when Uncle Mike told them I was his guest, even as he condemned me to sing in front of the whole lot. I was so lost in thought, I almost missed Naomi's answer to my question.
You have connections to the werewolves. I want you to ask the Alpha to intercede for us. If Stefan is dead, Then so are we. Marsilia will scatter us among the menageries of the other vampires who will imprison us until we die.
All the other vampires kill their...
I almost said food, and I couldn't think of any more diplomatic way to put it, so I just stopped speaking.
She shook her head.
Not on purpose, but most of them don't have Stefan's control. But we are Stefan's. That means that their mind tricks won't work as well on us, and those of us who are bound like Joey. When a bound one is made over by someone they're not bound to, odd things happen. I've heard people say that's why Stefan was never properly subservient to Marsilia, that he was bound by a different vampire. They won't want to keep us around long.
So if Stefan is permanently dead,
she smiled bleakly at me.
We all are.
And you believe the werewolves could do something about this?
She nodded.
Marsilia owes them blood price. This sorcerer is a vampire, which makes him Marsilia's business. When the two werewolves joined the hunt, they became her responsibility. Since one was hurt and the other... She shrugged expressively.
If your alpha asks us as his price, she'll give us to him.
What about worries over your silence, I asked. If we belong to the werewolves, our silence becomes their problem.
I'll speak to the werewolves, I promised, but I don't have much influence,
especially if Adam and Samuel were dead too. The thought made it hard to breathe, so I shoved it away.
Tell me about the vampires and how the Seethe operates.
Naomi gathered herself together visibly, and when she spoke, she sounded like the professor she had apparently once been.
I'll start from the general, and then go to the specific, shall I?
You understand that generalities do not account for variations. Just because most vampires follow this pattern doesn't mean that they all do.
All right, I told her, wishing I had a notebook so I could take notes.
A vampire likes to keep a food supply at hand, so they live with a small group of humans, usually anywhere from 3 to 7. 3 are enough to provide food for a month before they die. 7 is enough for 6 months, because if the vampires feed lightly on each, their prey lasts longer.
There aren't 40 people disappearing from the Tri-Cities every month, I protested. And I know that Marsilia has more than 10 vampires.
Naomi smiled grimly.
They don't hunt in their own territory.
Stefan found me in Chicago teaching at Northwestern. Rachel's from Seattle. I think the only one of us Stefan found in the Tri-Cities was Daniel, and he was hitchhiking down from Canada.
For some reason, her speaking of Daniel made me glance over by the sink. But sometime while we'd been talking, the young man must have left. When I thought about it, I realized that I hadn't heard him for a while. It bothered me that I hadn't heard him leave.
So the vampires have to continually replenish their menageries?
Most of them.
Naomi nodded. Stefan, as you know, does things differently. There are 14 of us who live here, and maybe a dozen more who visit occasionally. Stefan doesn't usually kill his prey.
Tommy, said Rachel in a small voice.
Naomi waved her hand dismissively.
Tommy was ill anyway.
She looked at me.
When the Fae came out, Stefan began to be concerned about the same things that caused the Fae to reveal themselves. He told the Seethe and the ruling council of vampires that they could no longer live as they were and expect to survive. He had already been maintaining a large menagerie because he didn't kill his people. He has a reputation for being soft-hearted. I'm told Marsilia thinks his concern for us is cute.
She gave me an ironic look.
He began to experiment. To look for ways the vampire could benefit the human race. He found me dying of leukemia and offered me a chance at life.
I did some adding in my head and frowned at her.
Rachel said you were a professor and he found you about the time the Fae came out. How old were you?
She smiled.
41.
That would mean she was in her 60s now. She didn't look it. She didn't look much older than I did.
Stefan already knew that longevity was something he could offer. One of his bound children had belonged to him for over a century before another vampire killed her.
How does feeding a vampire make you live longer? I asked.
It's the exchange of blood, said Rachel.
She put a finger against her lips and licked it suggestively.
He takes and then gives a little back. Since I started feeding, I've been able to see in the dark. I can even bend a tire iron.
She glanced at me from under her lashes to see how I took her revelation.
Ick, I thought hard, and she frowned at me, as if my reaction disappointed her. Maybe she expected me to be more horrified, or intrigued. And my leukemia has been in remission since 1981, Naomi added prosaically. Joey said she was always a little psychic, but after she became Stefan's, she could move things without touching them.
Not much, said Rachel. All she could do was wiggle a spoon across the table.
So vampires can heal diseases? I asked. Naomi shook her head. With bloodborne diseases, the vampires help a lot, things like sickle cell anemia and a host of lesser-known stuff. Stefan had some success with some of the autoimmune diseases like MS and HIV. Except for the leukemia, though, Stefan found that he couldn't help cancer patients or full-blown AIDS patients like Tommy either. So Stefan was trying to create a politically correct vampire? I asked. The idea was mind-boggling. I can see the headlines. Malign vampire only wants to save people. Or better yet, vampire estates. Come to our modern community compound. We'll heal your ills, make you stronger, and give you eternal life.
Join us for lunch,
contributed Rachel with a toothy smile. Naomi gave me a dry look. He's not that ambitious, I don't think. And he's run into problems.
Marsilia?
Naomi looked thoughtful. For a long time, Marsilia was more of a figurehead than a leader. Stefan said she was pouting because she was exiled. After last winter, she began noticing more. He was hoping for her support in his efforts, hoping she could push some of the others into more humane treatment of their menageries. But, I started. But, there are a lot of problems with what Stefan is trying to do. First of all, not many vampires can afford to support as many people as he is. And any less than 12 of us and we start dying. And, two, most vamps cannot control as many people as Stefan. There aren't many vampires who can make their sheep love them. She looked pointedly at Rachel as she said the last sentence.
Stefan says that the biggest problem is self-control, Rachel said, ignoring Naomi. Vampires are predators. They kill things.
Naomi nodded. A lot of them choose not to control themselves. They say it ruins the enjoyment of their meal. But all of them lose control sometimes when they are feeding. Even Stefan. For a moment, I caught a glimpse of horror in her eyes, but she lowered her eyelids and banished it. The longer a person belongs to a vampire, the harder it is for the vampire to keep from killing him. Stefan says that with the bound ones, the urge to kill is very, very strong, and it only gets worse with time. He used to send Joey off to her family in Reno for months on end. The urge affects all vampires, not just the one the person is bound to. That's why Stefan didn't kill Andre outright. Daniel was bound. It could have been accidental.
Andre's menageries don't last very long, Rachel told me. He's never created a vampire except for Daniel because he kills them before their time.
I don't know what she saw in my face, only heard her start to speak quickly, something to the effect that Andre wasn't evil.
Not like Estelle or some of the others who like to play with their food.
But I wasn't listening to her. I was looking at Daniel's tear-streaked face. I'd only met him, though, once, and I recognized his scent more than his features. He was standing behind Rachel, looking at me and whispering. It took me a few seconds to realize that it had been him I'd seen curled up by the sink. I hadn't recognized his scent then, but the dead don't always appear to all my senses. Then I realized what he was saying and stopped fretting about why I hadn't realized who he was the first time I'd seen him.
"He ate me," he whispered in a quietly frantic voice. "He ate me,"
over and over. "Where?" I asked, coming to my feet. "Where is he, Daniel?" But it was no use. Daniel was no Mrs. Hannah, who had died quietly and gone on with her usual routine. Some ghosts have urgent business to conduct, stopping over for a few minutes to leave a final message of love or anger with someone important. Some of them, especially the ones who died in traumatic ways, are caught in the moment of their death. Those are the most common kind, like Henry VIII's fifth wife, Catherine Howard, who runs screaming in the halls of the Tower of London. "Daniel?" I asked, though his lack of reaction had robbed me of some of my urgency. Rachel had quit speaking, hopped off her stool, and looked at Daniel. Naomi was just staring at me. He faded after a moment more, and even after I couldn't see him anymore, his voice lingered.
Did you see him?
Whispered Rachel. That's a cruel trick to play, Naomi snapped at me. I looked at her. You live with vampires and don't believe in ghosts? I asked.
Daniel's dead,
Rachel whispered. I nodded. I wondered how a vampire could be a ghost. Weren't they already dead? I was starting to get punchy from lack of sleep. Naomi turned to the girl. Rachel.
I saw him too, she said hollowly. Just for a moment, but it was him. If Daniel's dead, Stefan wouldn't let anything happen to him, not if he were alive.
She looked around a little wildly and then left the room. I heard her quick footsteps up the stairs. What did he tell you? I couldn't tell by her words if Naomi believed me or not, but it didn't really matter. Nothing. I decided not to share what he had said. It wouldn't help anyone here, and it didn't sound as if Rachel had heard him. I got up and opened the cupboards at random until I found a glass. I filled it with water and drank, pretending my throat was dry because I was thirsty, not because I was scared. Had the sorcerer really eaten Daniel? Unwelcome, the memory of Littleton killing the woman at the hotel hit me as a full-throttle flashback. Sight, smell, and sound. Just for a moment. But for that moment, I was back in the hotel room. I must not have acted strangely, because when I turned back to Naomi, she wasn't looking at me like she'd have stared at someone who'd screamed. I set the glass carefully down on the counter. If vampires live in their menageries, I said, proud of my steady tone, who lives in the seethe? Only the strongest vampires can live on their own and survive purely on human blood. All the others live in the seethe. They are the mistress's menagerie, Naomi told me after a moment. I worked it out. She feeds on the vampires? Naomi nodded. And gives them a little, very little blood in return. Without that blood, the weaker vampires would die, and only the mistress is allowed to feed other vampires and feed from them. She keeps humans there to nourish them all, but without her, the lesser vampires would die. Allowed to feed? I asked. If there is a rule against it, that must mean that she gains something from feeding off vampires. Yes, I'm not sure what. Strength and power, I think, and the ability to limit the actions even of those vampires she didn't directly beget. She made Stefan and, I think, Andre, but Estelle and most of the others aren't hers. When she quit paying attention to the seethe, Stefan and Andre ran things for her, but some of the older vampires became unruly. Estelle and Bernard, I suggested, remembering the man in the dapper suit. Naomi nodded. The four of them, Stefan, Andre, Estelle, and Bernard, are the only vampires strong enough to live outside the seethe. Stefan says that once they can live without feeding from the mistress, vampires start to get territorial, so they're sent out to gain their own menageries. She paused. Five, actually. The wizard lives on his own. The wizard? I asked. She nodded her head. Wolf, you've seen him because Stefan said he was present at the trial. He looks younger than Daniel and has white blonde hair. The boy who'd worked the magic on the chair. While Marsilia wasn't paying attention, Estelle and Bernard managed to make a few new vampires and kept them to themselves. They're feeding off the new vamps, I said, following her story. That makes them more powerful than they otherwise would be. Right. This part I'm not certain of. Okay? There's some reason that Marsilia can't take the new vampires from them. I think it's because once the new vampires have exchanged blood with their maker a few times, they'll sicken and maybe die without the blood of that particular vampire. Vampires reproduce very slowly, so they are very careful with the new ones, even if it means that Bernard and Estelle gain power that Marsilia cannot afford for them to have. So, Naomi continued, there's dissension in the ranks. Stefan believed that Marsilia is losing her grip on the seethe. No one is in outright rebellion, but the mistress is not in absolute control, either. What does the addition of the sorcerer do to her position? I asked. And she smiled at me like a student who'd come to the right conclusion. A vampire is in town causing trouble, she said. It's a matter for Marsilia to handle. But this one has proven stronger than Stefan. Vampires, the older they get, the more afraid they are of death. Stefan told me that he thought the reason she sent only him out after the sorcerer wasn't to punish him, but because she could send no one else, because because they wouldn't go. Of the five most powerful vampires, only Stefan and Andre are truly hers. So she really had been desperate when she came to me.
Why doesn't Marsilia go after him herself? She's the mistress and the most powerful of them all.
Naomi pursed her lips. Would your Alpha go after such a dangerous creature when he had warriors to fight in his stead?
He already has, I told her. An Alpha who counts on others to fight his battles doesn't stay Alpha long.
He's not dead. I turned at the sound of a masculine voice behind me. The man who filled the doorway looked to be somewhere in his 50s, with an underlying strength buried beneath his somewhat thickened midsection. I glanced at his hands and was unsurprised to see them roughened from a lifetime of hard work. Like me, this was a man who'd made his living with his hands.
"Who's not dead, Ford?" Naomi asked, but he ignored her entirely. His bright eyes on mine, he took another step into the room. I couldn't look away from his gaze.
"He's not dead," he said intensely. "If he were dead, the threshold would be gone. I was here when Andre couldn't get through. Only Stefan made this a home. I'd know if he were dead."
"Stop it, Ford," Naomi said sharply, and the scent of her fear distracted me from Ford's brilliant, liquid crystal gaze. I blinked and jerked my gaze away. It was still daylight, so Ford couldn't be a vampire, but I was guessing he was the next thing to it.
He grabbed my arm and hauled me off the stool with less effort than it should have taken. I was used to big men. Samuel was over 6 feet tall, but this man made me feel small. He didn't know how to fight, though, because I didn't have any trouble breaking his grip. I took 2 steps back, and Naomi put herself between us.
"Daniel is gone," I told him. "I saw his ghost myself. Warren, one of the werewolves who was with Stefan, was badly injured and left for the pack to find. I don't know how our other wolf is, or Stefan either. I intend to find out."
Naomi stepped closer and patted him on the chest. "Shh, it's all right." Her soothing tones were very close to what Adam used on his new wolves when they became overset. "You might want to go now, Mercedes," she said in the same soothing tones. "Ford is one of the bound." And that meant more than his being able to become a vampire when he died, I saw. The brightness of his eyes wasn't some genetic fluke, but the precursor to the glowing gems I'd seen vampires display in anger or lust. He grabbed Naomi impatiently, I think to thrust her aside so he could get to me, but she tilted her head and presented the side of her neck to him, and he hesitated, clearly caught by the sight of her pulse. If she'd been merely afraid, I'd have stayed there and tried to help her, but her eagerness for him was uncomfortably strong. I turned and left as he bent for her neck. I was a half mile from Stefan's house before I took my first full breath. I'd learned a lot there, more than I'd expected, and nothing that would help me find Littleton. I'd no idea where the other vampire menageries were, and even if I did, I doubted that the sorcerer would be living with his master, assuming Littleton's maker was one of Marsilia's vampires. There were any number of vampires who might have made the sorcerer to cause trouble for Marsilia, or a vampire from another seethe might have noticed the trouble she was in and sent the sorcerer to soften the seethe up in preparation for a hostile takeover. All of that was Marsilia's problem, and not mine. I needed to find out where the sorcerer was. I was fully engaged in fruitless speculation, and it wasn't until I was guiding the rabbit down the twisty drop from the hills back down into the alluvial plain of East Kennewick that I realized I'd driven halfway home. Maybe Warren knew what had sent Adam and Samuel after Littleton. I headed for Adam's house. It had only been a few hours, but werewolves heal very fast once they're able to change. The werewolf I'd had to argue with last night was back on door duty, but he dropped his eyes and opened the front door without arguing. There were a few of the pack draped over the couches in the living room, but no one I was particularly friendly with.
"Mercy?"
Jessie was in the kitchen, a cup of hot chocolate clutched in her hands. "Has your father or Samuel called?" I asked, though the answer was obvious from her face. She shook her head.
"Daryl said you were looking for them."
Her tone asked me a whole slew of questions. What kind of danger was her father in? Why was it me looking for him and not the whole pack? "How is Warren?" I asked, because I didn't have any answers I wanted to tell Adam's daughter.
"Still bad," she told me. Daryl is worried he's not going to make it because he's not healing like he should be, and he won't eat.
I need to see if I can talk with him. I left Jessie to her cocoa and her worries. The door to the basement was shut, but I opened it without knocking. Anyone likely to be in the room, with the possible exception of Kyle, would have heard me talking to Jessie. Daryl's dark eyes met mine from the rocking chair he sat in. I stood in the doorway and stared into his eyes.
Mercy?
Kyle's voice was strained, and he sounded almost as tired as I felt.
Just a moment,
I murmured without taking my eyes off of Daryl. I don't know why he felt he had to challenge me right now, but I didn't want to be taking orders from him today. Finally, Daryl looked down. It wasn't submissive as much as it was dismissive, but it was good enough for me. I turned away from him without a word and walked over to the barred wall that Kyle was still leaning against.
What's wrong? Kyle asked.
Stupid werewolf games. I crouched in front of the cage door. Warren had changed back into human form. He was curled up with his back to us. Someone had thrown a blanket over him.
Daryl's just a little confused right now.
Daryl snorted. I didn't look at him, but I felt my lips curl in sympathy. Following a coyote would stick in any wolf's craw, I said. Sitting around when there's things that need doing is worse. If Daryl were a lesser wolf, he'd have killed me when I walked into the room.
Daryl's snort evolved into an honest laugh.
You're not in any danger from me, Mercy. Confused, though I might be.
I risked a glance and relaxed, because Daryl had lost the look of lazy readiness and appeared merely exhausted. I smiled at him. Can Warren talk? Daryl shook his head.
Samuel said he thought it would be a few days. Apparently there was some damage to his throat. I don't know what effect changing had on his prognosis. He won't eat.
He talked in his sleep, Kyle told me.
He was watching Daryl without bothering to conceal his dislike. Daryl had always had a problem with Warren, even before he'd found out Warren wasn't subservient to him. Dominant wolves were always prickly around each other, unless one of them was the alpha. It meant that Daryl tended to be nastily autocratic when Warren was around.
What did he say?
Daryl snapped, his chair rolling abruptly forward.
Nothing that matters to you, Cal replied, uncaring of the danger of irritating a werewolf.
I was more interested in the way Warren's shoulders were tightening. You're going to disturb him if you start fighting, I said. Daryl, have you heard from Bran?
He nodded, his attention still focused on Kyle.
He's coming up. He's got some business to finish, so he won't be able to get here until late tonight.
Good, I said. I want you to go up and eat something.
He looked at me, surprised.
I smiled. A hungry werewolf is a cranky werewolf. Go eat something before you eat somebody. He stood up and stretched. The stiffness in his movement told me that he'd been in that chair for a very long time. I waited until he was gone, then opened the door of the cell.
I've spent most of the last few hours with Daryl telling me that wasn't a good idea, commented Kyle.
Probably isn't, I agreed, but Warren listened to me this morning. I sat on the end of the mattress and pulled the blanket down so it covered Warren's feet better. Then I crawled onto it between the wall and Warren. His face was just a few inches from mine, and I saw his battered nostrils flutter a little and breathed into them so he'd know it was me. The hours since I'd last seen him hadn't improved his appearance any. His bruises had darkened, and his nose and lips were more swollen. Daryl was right. He should be healing faster than this. But Kyle said he had spoken.
It's all right, I told Warren. It's just Kyle and me here.
His lashes moved, and one eye opened just a slit, then closed. Adam and Samuel are missing, I told him. Daniel is dead. His eye opened a little, and he made a soft noise.
Was he alive when you last saw him?
A shift that might have been a nod. I reached up and touched a place on his cheek that looked unbruised, and he relaxed infinitesimally. Among the wolves, body language can tell me almost as much as words.
Did you tell Adam and Samuel where to find Littleton? I asked.
Warren's heart rate picked up, and he shifted on the bed. His eye opened again, and a tear of pure frustration spilled over. I touched his lips.
Shh, not you, I see. But someone told them.
He stared at me, tormented.
Do you know where they went?
Samuel got a phone call last night before they left, said Kyle. Dumbfounded, I lifted my head to stare at Kyle, who was kneeling on the floor on the other side of Warren's bed.
Why didn't you tell anyone?
Daryl didn't ask, he said. He assumed I was sleeping the whole time and wasn't in the mood to listen when I tried to talk to him. I should have told you earlier today, but to be quite honest, I was a little distracted.
I relaxed back on the bed.
Damned werewolves. I suppose it never even occurred to Daryl to pay attention to a human.
Daryl had a PhD, damn it. You'd think he'd be smart enough to pay attention to a man with the brains to be one of the top attorneys in the state. An attorney, moreover, with an Ivy League education.
If you think being a human around them is frustrating, you should try being a coyote, I told him.
So what did Samuel say?
I didn't have much hope of anything useful. If he'd said where they were going, for instance, Kyle wouldn't have let pride keep him from giving Daryl the information. Samuel didn't have a chance to say anything to whoever called. They called, said a few sentences, and hung up. Samuel grabbed Adam and said, "Let's go."
I gave him a rueful look. They ignored you, too.
He smiled at me this time, a tired smile. I'm not used to being ignored. Irks me when they do it to me, too.
I shifted my gaze back to Warren. Did you hear what the caller said?
I didn't expect he had, so his stillness took me by surprise.
His battered mouth tried to shape a word. I listened carefully, but it was Kyle leaning over the bed who caught it.
Trap?
Warren, I know the werewolves have to stay away from Littleton, I told him. Did he call them and get them to come to him?
He moved his head just enough for an affirmative.
Did you hear where?
He lay unmoving.
Warren, I won't let any of the wolves go near him. Neither Kyle nor I will tell the pack where they are, not until Bran gets here. I'll just tell the vampires. It's their problem in the first place.
He tried, but neither Kyle nor I could tell what he said. Finally, Kyle said, "Look, it's obviously not a yes or a no. Warren, my dear, did you hear part of it?" Clearly exhausted by his efforts, Warren nodded. He relaxed and said one thing more.
"Church," I said, and saw by Warren's face I'd gotten it right. "That's all?"
I touched his face as he relaxed.
"Go back to sleep, Warren. We'll make sure Bran knows everything."
He gave a shuddering sigh and relaxed fully into unconsciousness.
"Kyle, would you make sure to tell Bran this much when he gets here? He should be here late tonight or early tomorrow morning."
I got out of Warren's bed as carefully as I could. "All right. What are you going to be doing?" I rubbed my face. It had taken a lot of willpower to crawl out of that bed when my whole body wanted to curl up with Warren and sleep.
"If I can find out where Littleton is before nightfall, I might be able to kill him."
With the handy-dandy vampire-killing kit in the trunk of my car. "Can I help?"
"Only by staying here with Warren. See if you can get him to eat when he stirs again."
Kyle looked at Warren, and his face held none of its usual sardonic humor when he said, "When you find the bastard who did this, kill him and make it hurt." I made him get up and come out of the cell with me. I didn't think Warren would hurt him, but I wasn't willing to take the chance.
My cell phone rang. It was Tony.
"You won't believe this," he said, "and I don't know if it helps."
"What?" I asked.
"The daytime incidents, with a few outliers, are in Kennewick. There's a broad pattern that seems to be centered around the KPD.
"The police station?" I asked.
"That's right. Although I suppose it could just as easily be centered around Kennewick High, or your place for that matter. But the police station's right in the middle."
"How broad's the pattern?" I asked.
"About 3, 3.5 miles. Some of the incidents are across the river in Pasco. There are outliers. Our specialist tells me that there are enough to be significant. A few in Richland, Benton City, and Burbank. Does this help?"
"I don't know," I told him. "Maybe. Thanks, Tony. I owe you a few favors for this."
"Just stop this thing."
"I'll do my best." I met Daryl at the top of the stairs.
"You were right," he told me. "Food helped."
"Mm," I said. "Samuel got a call last night. Warren doesn't know where they went, though."
"Warren's awake and talking?"
I shook my head. "I wouldn't call it talking, and he's asleep again. It was Kyle who heard the phone call, as he apparently tried to tell you." I watched it sink in.
You might think about listening to Kyle, I told him gently. Then, to let him off the hook, I asked, Do you know why my being able to talk to ghosts would scare the vampires? He grunted a negative.
I don't see how that would help. Last I heard, ghosts avoid evil.
He walked past me without touching me. I don't think he even realized what he'd given me. Ghosts are not people. No matter how well Mrs. Hanna conversed, she was still just a memory of the person she had been. I was so stupid. She'd told me that she changed her routine, and all I'd thought was how sad it was, because without her usual habits, she'd probably fade quickly. I hadn't wondered why she'd changed her routine. Ghosts, pattern ghosts, just don't do that. Someone had told her to, she'd said. I couldn't remember who, just that it was a man's name. Her route wandered all over Kennewick. If the sorcerer was in Kennewick, she might have run into him. Jesse looked up from the kitchen table as I ran down the stairs.
Mercy, did you find out something?
Maybe, I told her as I kept going to the door. I have to find someone, though. I looked at my watch. 8:27. I had an hour and a half before dark, if the sorcerer had to wait for full dark to awaken. Chapter 12. For most of the time that I'd lived in the Tri-Cities, Mrs. Hanna had pushed her grocery cart along the same path from dawn to dusk. I'd never actually followed her, but I'd seen her any number of places, so I had a pretty good idea about most of her route. I didn't have any idea about how she changed it, so I had to look everywhere. When I passed the first church, I pulled over to the side of the road and pulled out a notebook I kept in the car and wrote down the name of the church and its address. After an hour, I had a list of 11 churches reasonably near the KPD, none of which had flaming signs that said, Sorcerer sleeping here. The sun was noticeably low in the sky, and my stomach was tight with dread. If I was wrong that the reason Mrs. Hanna had to change her route was to avoid Littleton, then I'd wasted the last hour. If I was right, I was still running out of time. I was also running out of places to look. I pulled over by Kennewick High and tried to think. If Mrs. Hanna hadn't changed her route, it would be easier to find her. If she hadn't been dead, it would have been easier yet. I was counting on being able to see her, but ghosts quite often manifest only to some senses. Disembodied voices, cold spots, or just a whiff of perfume. If I didn't find her soon, it would be dark, and I'd have to face Littleton during the height of his power, both as a demon and a vampire. I stopped at the light on Garfield and 10th. It was one of those lights that stayed red for a long time, even when there was no oncoming traffic. At least I wouldn't have to face Littleton alone after dark, because I can call Andre. I pounded my hands on the steering wheel, impatient with the red light. But if I don't find Mrs. Hanna before night, I won't find her at all. Mrs. Hanna went home at night. I said it out loud because I couldn't believe how stupid I'd been. Mrs. Hanna goes home at night. There was still no traffic coming, so I put my foot down, and for the first time in my adult life, I ran a red light. Mrs. Hanna had lived in a little trailer park along the river, just east of the Blue Bridge, and it took me 5 minutes and 3 red lights to get down to that area. I ran those lights, too. I found her pushing her cart on the sidewalk next to the VW dealership. Parking my car on the wrong side of the street, I jumped out, biting back the urge to shout her name. Startled ghosts tend to disappear. With that in mind, I didn't say anything at all when I caught up to her. Instead, I walked along beside her for a quarter of a block.
"What a nice evening," she said at last. "I do think we're due for a break in the weather."
"I hope so." I took 2 deep breaths. "Mrs. Hanna, pardon my rudeness, but I was wondering about that change in your usual walk."
"Of course, dear," she said absently. "How is that young man of yours?"
"That's a problem," I told her. "I think that he's run into some trouble. Could you tell me again why you came by my shop at a different time?"
"Oh, yes, very sad. Joe told me the way I usually walk wasn't safe. Our poor Kennewick is getting to be such a big city, isn't it? Terrible when it's not safe for a woman to walk in the daytime anymore."
"T,
Terrible, I agreed. Who is Joe, and where is it he doesn't want you walking?
She stopped her cart and smiled at me gently.
Oh, you know Joe, dear. He's been the janitor at the old Congregational Church forever. He's very upset at what's happened to his building. But then who consults the janitor?
Where is it? I asked.
She looked over at me with a puzzled look on her face.
Do I know you, dear? You look familiar.
Before I could form a suitable reply, she glanced up at the setting sun.
I'm afraid I must be going. It's not safe after dark, you know.
She left me standing alone in front of the trailer court.
Congregational Church, I said, sprinting for my car.
I knew that none of the churches I'd written down had the word congregational in it, but I also had a phone book I kept in the car. There were no listings for a congregational church in the yellow pages, so I turned to the white pages and found a single listing in Pasco, which was not helpful. Mrs. Hannah's route didn't take her across the river. I pulled out my cell phone and called Gabriel's phone number. One of his little sisters had a thing about ghosts. If her mother wasn't there and you let her get started, she'd tell ghost stories the whole time she worked cleaning the office.
Hi, Mercy, he answered. What's up?
I need to talk to Rosalinda about some local ghost stories, I told him. Is she there? There was a little pause.
Are you having trouble with ghosts?
No, I need to find one. He pulled his mouth away from the phone.
Rosalinda, come over here.
I'm watching TV. Can't Tia do it? She hasn't done anything today.
It's not work. Mercy wants to pick your brains.
There were a few small noises as Gabriel handed over the phone.
Hello?
Her voice was much more hesitant when she was talking to me than it had been when she was talking to her brother. Didn't you tell me you did a report on local ghosts for school last year?
Yes,
she said with a little more enthusiasm.
I got an A.
I need to know if you've heard anything about the ghost of a janitor named Joe who used to work at a church. He didn't have to be a ghost, I thought. After all, I talked to Mrs. Hannah, and I wasn't a ghost. And even if he was a ghost, that didn't mean there were stories about him.
Oh, yes, yes.
Gabriel didn't have an accent at all, but his sister's clear Spanish vowels added color to her voice as it brightened with enthusiasm.
Joe is very famous. He worked his whole life cleaning his church until he was 64, I think. One Sunday, when the priest, no, they called him something else, pastor, I think, or minister. Anyway, when he came to open the church, he found Joe dead in the kitchen, but he stayed there anyway. I talked to people who used to go to church there. They said that sometimes there were lights on at night when there was no one there, and doors would lock themselves. One person said they saw him on the stairway, but I'm not sure I believe that. That person just liked to tell stories.
Where is it? I asked her.
Oh, not too far from our apartment, she said. Down on 2nd or 3rd, just a couple of blocks from Washington.
Not far from the police department either.
I went over to take pictures of it. It isn't a church anymore. The church people built a new building and sold the old one to another church about 20 years ago. Then it sold to some other people who tried to run a private school. They went bankrupt. There was a divorce, and one of them, I can't remember if it was the husband or the wife, killed themselves. The church was empty the last time I went by there.
Thank you, Rosalinda, I said. That's exactly what I needed to know.
Do you believe in ghosts? She asked. My mother says they are nonsense.
Perhaps they are, I said, not wanting to contradict her mother. But there are a lot of people who believe all sorts of nonsense. Take care, she laughed.
You too. Goodbye, Mercy.
I hit the end button and looked at the darkening sky. There was one way to tell if the vampires were up. I pulled Andre's card out of my back pocket and called him.
Hello, Mercy, he answered. What are we doing tonight?
As soon as Andre answered the phone, I knew that my chance at finding the sorcerer in a daytime stupor was gone. I could wait until the next morning. Then we could go after him with Bran. Bran was, in my mind, exempt from the effects of the demon. I just couldn't imagine the thing that could break his icy calmness. But if we waited for help, waited for the morning, I was almost certain that both Adam and Samuel would be dead. I know where he is, I told Andre. Meet me at my shop.
Marvelous. I will be there as soon as I can, he said. I have some preparations to do first, but I won't be long.
I drove there to wait for him. I called Brand's cell phone and got a voicemail request. I took it as a sign that he would be too late to help. I told him to look in the safe in my shop and gave him the combination. Then I sat down at the computer and typed out everything pertinent about what I was doing and where I was going. I wasn't going to leave everyone wondering what had happened to me, the way everyone else who had gone after Littleton had. When I finished, Andre still wasn't there, so I checked my home email. My mother had sent me two emails, but the third was from an unfamiliar address with attached files. I was about to delete it when I saw that the subject line read, Corey Littleton. Beckworth, true to his word, had gotten information about Littleton for me. His email was short and to the point. Ms. Thompson, here is all the information I could find. It comes from a friend of mine who is with the Chicago police and owes me some favors. Littleton disappeared from Chicago about a year ago, where he was being investigated as a murder suspect. My friend told me that if I knew where this guy was, he'd appreciate hearing about it, and the FBI are looking for him as well. Thanks again, Beckworth. There were four PDF files and a couple of JPEGs. I opened the JPEGs. The first picture was a full-color shot of Littleton standing on the corner of a city street. On the bottom right-hand corner, the photo was date-stamped April of last year. He was a good 40 pounds heavier than when I'd last seen him. There was no way to be certain, but something about the way he was standing made me believe that he'd been human then. I opened up the second picture. Littleton in a nightclub talking to another man. Littleton's face was animated, as I'd never seen it in real life. The man he was talking to was turned so all I could see was his profile. But that was enough. It was Andre. Andre pulled up just as I finished printing out a second letter to Bran. I tossed it into the safe, grabbed Z's vampire-slaying backpack, and went out to meet my fate. Andre drove us out of my parking lot in his black BMW Z8. It suited him in the same way that Stefan's version of the mystery machine had suited him. It surprised me a little, because Andre had never impressed me as elegant and powerful. I gave him a quick look under my lashes and realized that tonight he was both, reminding me that he was one of the six most powerful vampires in the Seethe. He'd turned a sorcerer into a vampire so that he could be the most powerful, and I was betting my life that he had lost control of the sorcerer the night Stefan and I met Littleton. Andre was something of an enigma to me, so I was trusting Stefan's judgment and the judgment of Stefan's menagerie that he was loyal to Marsilia and jealous of Stefan. Daniel had been a trial, to see what Littleton could do against a new-made vampire. If matters had not worked out well, Andre could have dealt with it. Daniel was his, after all. But Littleton had proven himself, so Andre had set him up against Stefan. But if Andre were still Marsilia's man, then he would not have condoned the bloodbath at the hotel. It was too likely to have drawn attention to the vampire. But the one thing that made me believe that Littleton was not following orders that night was that Stefan survived. Andre, I thought, would have killed Stefan. Not because of Marsilia's affection, but because Stefan was always, so clearly, the better man. So I got in a car with the vampire who'd created Littleton, because I believed he wanted the sorcerer as much as I did. He couldn't afford for Littleton to continue to run free, making more and more trouble for him. And I got in that car because I knew that Andre was my only chance to keep Adam and Samuel alive.
A church is a holy ground, Andre informed me when I told him where we were going. He can't be in a church. He's a vampire.
I rubbed my face, ignored the little voice that kept repeating, "We have to find them," and tried to think. I was so tired. I'd been up, I realized, for over 40 hours without sleep. Okay, I said. I remember hearing vampires can't stand on holy ground. Slipped in among a dozen things that weren't true, say, for instance, the one about vampires crossing water. But if Littleton was staying in a church, how could you explain it? He turned onto Third and slowed way down so we could look for likely buildings. Gabriel's sister hadn't told me which side of Washington the church was on. Since my shop was east of here, that's where we started. I pressed several buttons and finally got my window to roll down so I could sniff the air.
All right, he said. Maybe the demon changes the rules, but they're not supposed to be able to abide holy ground either, or the church could have been desecrated.
It was a school for a while, I said hopefully. He shook his head.
Not unless it was a whorehouse. It takes one of the great sins to desecrate a church. Adultery, murder, something of that nature.
How about a suicide? I asked. Gabriel's sister hadn't said the suicide had taken place in the church, but she hadn't said it hadn't happened there either. He glanced at me.
Then I think a demon would take great delight in living in a desecrated church.
The traffic on Washington was light tonight, and he goosed the little sports car across all four lanes without stopping for the stop sign. When this is over, I muttered darkly, I am never getting in a car with a vampire driving again. Rosalinda was right. The church was two blocks off of Washington. There were no signs around it, but it was unmistakably a church. It was bigger than I expected, almost three times the size of the church I attended on Sundays. The old church had once had a fair-sized yard, but there was little left of it but sunburnt weeds chopped almost level with the ground. The parking lot had fared little better. The blacktop had worn down until it was more rock than tar, and bleached weeds poked out through branching cracks in the surface. I looked, but I couldn't see any sign of the BMW Littleton had been driving. Andre pulled over as soon as we saw the church, parking his car across the street, in front of a two-story Victorian home that looked as though it might once have been a farmhouse. I don't see his car, I said.
Maybe he's already out hunting, said Andre. But I think you're right. He was here. This is some place he would stay.
He closed his eyes and inhaled. It made me realize that he hadn't been breathing tonight, except a couple of shallow breaths before he talked. I must be getting used to being around vampires.
Ugh.
I took a deep breath myself, but there were too many scents around. Dogs, cats, cars, blacktop that had baked all day in the hot sun, and plants. I knew without looking that there was a rose garden behind the house we were standing in front of, and that someone nearby was composting. I couldn't smell werewolf, demon, or vampire, except for Andre. I hadn't realized how much I'd been counting on some sign that Adam or Samuel had been here. I don't smell anything. Andre lifted an eyebrow, and I realized that under the right circumstances he was very good-looking, and that I'd been right. There was something different about him, something more tonight.
He's not stupid, he said. Only a stupid vampire leaves a trail to his doorstep.
There was a little bit of pride in his voice. He looked at the church a moment, then started walking across the street, leaving me to trot after him. "Shouldn't we be practicing a little stealth?" I asked.
"If he's at home, he'll know we're here anyway," he told me helpfully. "If he's not, then it doesn't matter."
I stretched my senses as far as I could, and wished that the roses didn't have quite so strong a scent. I couldn't smell anything. I wished I was certain that Andre would fight on my side tonight. "So if we're not trying to take him by surprise," I asked, "why did you park across the street?"
I paid over $100,000 for that car, Andre told me mildly. And I'm moderately fond of it. I'd hate to see it destroyed in a fit of temper.
Why aren't you more afraid of Littleton? I asked. I was afraid. I could smell my own fear over and above the roses, which had, oddly enough, grown stronger after we crossed the street. Andre stepped off the road and onto the sidewalk, then came to a full stop and looked at me.
I fed deeply this evening, he said with an odd smile. The mistress herself did me that honor. With the ties that already bind us and her blood fresh within me, I can call upon her gifts and her power at my need. It will take more than a new-made vampire, even one aided by a demon, to defeat us.
I remembered how easily Littleton had subdued Stefan and had my doubts. "Then why didn't Marsilia just come herself?" I asked. His jaw dropped in genuine shock.
"Marsilia is a lady. Women do not belong in combat."
"So you brought me instead?" He opened his mouth, then closed it again, looking a little embarrassed by what he'd been about to say to me. What? I asked, beginning to be a little amused, which was better than terrified. Isn't it polite to tell someone she's expendable because she's not a vampire? At a loss, he started up the cement steps that led to the worn double doors that hadn't been painted in too many years. I followed, but stayed a step behind.
No, he said finally, his hand on the doorknob, and I prefer to be polite.
He turned to look down at me.
My mistress was certain that you were the only person who would be able to find this vampire. She gets glimpses of the future sometimes. Not often, but what she does see is seldom wrong.
So do we all survive? I asked. He shook his head.
I do not know. I do understand, though, that you have taken great risk for the honor of the seed. You are so fragile.
He reached out and rested his fingertips against my cheek.
Almost human. On my honor, I promise to do everything in my power to see that you are safe.
His eyes caught me for a moment before I took two quick steps back, all but falling over the steps. Stefan's honor I trusted. Andre's was questionable. Both of the front doors were locked, but neither had been designed to keep out a vampire. He put a shoulder against one of the doors and broke the frame so the door swung open freely. Apparently, we weren't being subtle tonight. I slid Z's backpack down my arms and retrieved the stake and knife. Z'd included the belt and sheath for the knife, so at least I didn't have to run around with a knife in one hand and the stake in the other. I waited for Andre to ask me what I was doing with a knife, but he ignored me. All of his attention was on the church. Andre stood poised outside the threshold. What happens if it is still holy ground? I asked, hurriedly tying the belt.
Then I burst into flames, he said. But if it was holy ground, I should have felt it before this.
As he spoke, he stepped through the doorway and stood fully inside the church.
This isn't hallowed ground, he told me rather redundantly.
I followed him into a large foyer and then looked around. The foyer was large enough for 10 or 20 people to have milled around comfortably. The flooring was linoleum tile, cracked and pitted with age. There was a wide stairway leading upward that had a rather nicely carved handrail. Beside the stairway was a pair of double doors, propped open, so I could see the large empty room beyond them that must have been the sanctuary. The whole church was dark, but there were windows high up that let in a little illumination from the streetlights outside. A real human might have had trouble navigating, but it was light enough for Andre and me. He stalked over to the sanctuary doors and sniffed.
"Come here, walker," he said, his voice dark and rough. "Tell me what you smell."
I could have told him from where I stood, but I stuck my head into the sanctuary. The ceiling soared 2 stories above our heads, with frosted windows on both walls that glimmered silver with the dim light of the city night. The floor was hardwood, scarred where pews had once been bolted in. The walls and some of the windows of the sanctuary had been covered with graffiti, probably done by the neighborhood kids. I just didn't see either a vampire or demon writing things like "For a Good Time Call" or "Juan Loves Penny." There were a few gang tags, too. At the far end from us was a raised platform. Like the rest of the room, it was stripped as well, the podium and organ or piano long gone. But someone had cobbled together a table out of cinder blocks. I didn't have to go closer to know what that table had been used for. "Blood and death," I said. I closed my eyes. It helped me catch the fainter sense and kept me from crying. "Ben," I said. "Warren."
"Daniel."
"And Littleton." We'd found the sorcerer's lair.
"But not Stefan."
Andre stood behind me, and his voice echoed in the rafters of the room. I couldn't read anything from his voice, but I was not comfortable with him at my back. I remembered Naomi telling me that all of the vampires lost control sometimes, and the room smelled of blood and death. I walked past him back out to the foyer. "Not Stefan," I agreed. "At least, not in there." There was a hallway on the other side of the foyer with doors opening off either side. I opened the doors and found three rooms and a closet with a hot water heater and a large fuse box.
"He won't be up here," Andre said.